Welcome to the Revolutionary Health Podcast. I am your host, Stephanie Center. I am a licensed clinician in search of how to live a meaningful and healthy life. I challenge both traditional and functional medicine ideologies in search of truth and wisdom. I allow room for curiosity and always keep an open mind. I enjoy deep conversations with my guests, giving them a safe space to share their research and personal observation, as I feel both equally contribute to the body of knowledge and human experience. Note that the opinions of my guests do not always reflect my own, whether I share that openly or not. And of course, the podcast is for educational purposes only. We do not offer medical advice. So grab a cup of coffee and join me for some intimate and unique discussions about finding wellness in the 21st century. Welcome to Revolutionary Health. I am your host, Stephanie Center. I have a special guest today, Brett Hawes of Holistic Health Masterclass, one of my all-time favorite podcasts, sits down with me for a productive conversation on who sets the standards of health. Before we dive in, I just want to be clear, we are not talking about divisive issues like vaccine efficacy or masks. This dialogue is not meant to be polarizing. And as always, my goal is to get you to be curious and ask questions. So in this episode, we cover who sets the standards of health, who defines what wellness is and how to achieve it. We talk about how our health officials appointed. We talk about ethical and logistical issues with the current model of health. Specifically, we cover issues of no risk, no competition, flip-flapping between regulatory entities and private companies, and then double standards of medical treatment. And then we end with the information war. So, who is Brett? I think he's a genius. He is a certified functional medicine practitioner and a clinical holistic nutritionist with 16 years of clinical experience. He runs an online clinic with a primary focus on chronic and complex digestive issues, hormone health, and autoimmune disease. He has been the lead faculty at the Institute of Holistic Nutrition for 14 years, where he now works as the student clinical advisor and has mentored close to 300 clinicians across North America. His new venture, the Practitioner Paradigm, is dedicated to supporting practitioners in clinical practice and business. Brett has worked with numerous health and wellness companies in roles of advisor, consultant, product educator, and product formulator. His podcast, Holistic Health Masterclass, again, one of my faves, is consistently ranked in the top 200 alternative health podcasts in the world, as high as number 18 on some charts, providing valuable health information to thousands of listeners in 57 countries. In 2020, he was nominated as one of the top 10 healthcare leaders by the IFAH. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Brett Hawes. Well, hi, Brett. I can't believe I'm talking to you right now. You're one of my health heroes. Brett's podcast is Holistic Health Masterclass, and I know y'all have heard me talk about it before, but it's a really enlightening podcast, and it gets you to think about things in different perspectives. So, Brett, I'm so thankful you're here today.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. And so, you know, today we're talking about health freedom, and I don't want this to be a triggering conversation for anyone. My goal is always to get you to maybe ask more questions, be curious about the things going on around you. So we're just going to have just a really simple conversation about standards of health. This is not going to be a conversation about the efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccine. I feel like that's a moving target to begin with, right? It was created for the original SARS-CoV-2, and now we are on to multiple variations. So I don't think that would be a productive conversation. We're not talking about rules, masks. I still can't find conclusive data whether COVID is airborne or droplet. And so that opens up a can of worms. Really just talking about the overarching governing bodies about health and wellness and ways that we can navigate that as humans. To open up, my first question for you, Brett, is who sets the standards for health? Who gets to make those decisions?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty broad topic if you want to talk about standards for health. And I think if you zoom out a little bit, In my world, I work as a functional medicine practitioner. I'm a clinical nutritionist, and I've been in practice for almost 20 years. I'm about 18 years in, so a long time now. And, you know, I always look at, if we zoom out, I look at standards for health in two different ways. So one is, in my world, I am looking at health as your highest potential, right? So are we in like optimal health? Those are, and that's another good word. So we optimal health, that can be mental health, it can be physical health, it could be any of those things, right? Spiritual health, right? Relationship health, financial health. So that's for me how I look at health in a productive way. Now, on the other side, we have to then look at the medical system and how does medicine, like what is their definition of health? And the medical definition of health is the absence of symptoms. All right. And so when you think about the absence of symptoms, well, there's lots of things that we can do to essentially make symptoms go away, right? I could take medication, and in fact, most medication works like that. And not, you know, meds themselves are not in and of itself a bad thing. Absolutely. Sometimes we need painkillers. Sometimes antidepressants can be good to, you know, get someone to the next level where you can get them off the antidepressants or what have you. But generally, medication is suppressive. So if you think about how your body works, if I, like I have a bit of a sinus infection right now, as you might hear, but that is my body basically trying to, you know, so you'll have excess mucus, you might have a fever, your body's essentially trying to get stuff out of itself, right, to heal you. But in an allopathic model or a medical model, what I would be doing right now if I was doing it is I would be taking things like decongestants, right? I would be taking things to stop the mucus. I would be taking things to suppress my fever. And so what I'm doing is I'm not allowing the body's natural processes to unfold in the way that they should. I'm actually suppressing all of these things. And so what I'm doing is I'm creating the illusion of health. But if I remove all of those things that are suppressing the symptoms, I'm actually no better off than what I was before. And hopefully that kind of answers your question in a zoomed out perspective.
I love that. Yes, absolutely. I say a lot that symptoms are the last thing to occur in a disease process. So if you have a symptom, that means you've had issues long before that symptom arrived. As far as looking at the medical system, you know, we're in a time where we're following like guidelines recommended by those in leadership positions. And I guess to kind of the second part to that question would be who defines what wellness is and how to achieve it if we're not defining it for ourselves?
Right. And I think, again, it ties in with what I just said. But if we're talking about guidelines, the question should really be who's creating these guidelines, one, and what evidence are they using to base guidelines off of? Okay. So people like to use the word evidence-based medicine, right, or evidence-based care. And I always say, but what if the evidence is no good? Like, what evidence are we basing our decisions off here? And then the third thing that we should consider is who stands to benefit from the recommendations that are being made? And if we lived in a blue sky world and we said, oh, all of these things are independent of one another, you know, we just have a philanthropic, benevolent, you know, government organizations that just had our best interests at heart. Drug companies just wanted nothing but to get us well. The science is completely objective and you know, but that's not how it works, unfortunately. And I think a lot of people think that's how it works, but there's mountains of data to show that that's just not the case. So coming back to your question, you know, how does this get defined, or what criteria are we using to come up with these guidelines? And I think that, you know, I'll pick one in the interest of time. Consider that, you know, how is science, like the, you know, the war on science, right? Or anti-science, like you hear people say, oh, you're anti-science, right? Mm-hmm. But the question is, you know, if you look at science, and this is a problem that doctors have, this is a problem that researchers have, is, you know, if I'm conducting a study, right? So let's say I'm doing clinical trials on whatever medication it is. If that clinical trial is funded by the pharmaceutical companies, there is a much higher likelihood that it's going to come out in favor of what they are trying to prove, Okay, that's not me saying that. There's extensive literature on that, and it's a big problem, right? So that's one side of things, right? Is are we shaping and modeling those studies to ensure that the outcome is the most favorable to what I'm trying to achieve, right? So that's one problem. The second problem is publication bias. And so when you think publication bias is basically, are we seeing, so let's say I publish, let's say we ran 70 studies, or these big clinical trials and what have you, and 35 of them came back and said, well, you know, that drug is not really showing a benefit. Perhaps it's actually showing negative efficacy, or perhaps it's actually causing harm by way of side effects and what have you. And then on the other side, we've got 35 studies that show, oh, this actually has some kind of benefit to whatever degree is irrelevant, right? So it might have a huge benefit, it might have a small benefit. And are we seeing all 70 studies? And what publication bias is I choose to publish the studies that are in favor of what I'm trying to get out there. Okay, there are books written on the subject, and it's fairly well known that publication bias is a big problem, whereby certain drugs, I forget the names now, but certain drugs where, you know, out of that example, that's actually a real world example, by the way. And what you'll find is 36 studies that are in favor have been published, and 3 studies that are not in favor are published. So the other 33 or 32 or what have you, they never see the light of day. And the problem that we have beyond that is that it's actually very difficult to even track down whether those studies were done or not. Do you know what I mean? So it's not to say that we have all the information and we're just, some of it's just being hidden from us, or some of, you know, some is being published and then the others we have to physically go and look for them. It's actually even more problematic where even if you go and look for them, you're not going to be able to find them because they've been wiped from the face of the earth. So, you know, these are the types of problems. And then you also have what's called problems with reproduction or reproducibility or replication. And so, again, that's fairly well known throughout science where, you know, are you able to replicate your study more than once? Is someone else able to come along and replicate that study? Well, it turns out that, you know, in the sciences generally, and there's a good Nature article on this, depending on which field you're talking about, the average is around 50%. So in other words, 50% of scientific studies cannot be replicated and reproduced, whether it's by someone else or whether it's by the researchers themselves. So coming back to this whole idea here, you know, what are we basing our evidence on and what are we basing these guidelines on? It gets very, very muddy very quickly, you know, unfortunately. And there's other things that we can talk into that, talk about. You know, financial interests, of course, is another big one. You know, and I think without, you know, hammering on about the pandemic here, but why is it that over the last 2 years, we have not even been allowed to talk about anything prevention related? We've not been able to talk about anything treatment related, yet we have frontline doctors, we have people that are actively working in ER situations that have had to feel their way in the dark and devise treatment protocols to save their patients. But we can't speak about that. You know, so this is where these guidelines, when you start getting into them, you know, one has to question where are they coming from and what are the motives behind them. And I also want to be clear, just before you carry on, I'm not fatalistic here, and I'm not saying that everything is nefarious and there's a big agenda behind absolutely everything. That's not what I'm saying at all. Yeah. I'm just saying that, I mean, I think if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, it's fairly well known that they have been caught many, many times. You know, they're some of the highest legal cases and fines in the world have been paid by pharmaceutical industries. So.
Yeah, something interesting to add to this, and I don't know if I don't know what your experience has been. So I graduated from occupational therapy school in 2013, and one of the rules that we had when we were students is for any paper or any presentation that we were going to give while we were in school, any research you were going to use for that paper or presentation had to be within the last, I think it was 7 years. So you weren't allowed to use old data. So I had nailed into my, you know, 21-year-old brain that anything older than, you know, 2007 was just bad data. It was bad. And now that I'm, you know, far removed from that time, I have an ethical issue with that, because some of the best research that I've read is old. And one of the things you don't have to really worry about with old data as much is who's funding. You know, if you're reading research from the 1920s or 30s, people are just curious back then. Like, well, what happens if we do this? What happens if we do that? It wasn't, you know, research wasn't a means to an end necessarily. And so that's just, while you were talking, I was thinking about just that other kind of nuanced part of what you were saying.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we hold science up on a pedestal, and I think that people like myself who are questioning science, we're not necessarily questioning the scientific method. I think the scientific method is absolutely critical. It's got us to where we are right now in human evolution. You know, this inquiry, coming up with a hypothesis, testing that hypothesis, having people challenge that hypothesis, and then that's how we hammer things out and we move forward, right? The problem that I have really with science in today's context is the corruption of science, the hijacking of science by corporations, the profiteering for science. These are, you know, and so when people say, you know, the air quotes anti-science, I think, you know, an anti-scientist, that is really what they're, which is an incorrect term, by the way. But when people say they're anti-science or branded as anti-science, I think that is what they're getting at, right? I would like to see 100% objective, purely objective science. I would like to see all of the data on whatever given topic it is, so that we can all make informed decisions, right? You know, can you imagine being a doctor and out of all of the published literature, you're only getting to see the things that are favorable, and now you're making recommendations for your patients based on that evidence, and you could actually be doing more harm than good.
Yeah,
that's a major ethical problem that actually has very real world physical consequences. You know, it's a serious matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the people who are the governing bodies who are defining wellness, I thought this was really interesting. So I started reading about, I live in the United States. So we get a lot of our advice from our chief medical advisor. And so I just kind of looked into the history of what is the chief medical advisor? What does that mean? And what I found was really interesting. So that position began in February of 2019. It's a rather new position.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And we've only had two physicians fill that role. The first person was Ronnie Jackson, who was previously, before having this position, he was the physician to the president. And this started with George Bush and ended with Donald Trump. And his first term as the chief medical advisor began in February of 2019, and it ended December 1st of 2019. And of course, our second medical advisor is infamous, Anthony Fauci. He began December 1st, 2019, and he is current. And this role is incumbent. So there's no like start and end date. It's really, he's appointed by the president. So it's not an elected role. And he's, you know, there's really no end in sight. There's no like, you know, usually, at least in the United States, I think most places in the world, you have a start date and an end date for your term of whatever position you're serving in a governmental role. And that is not the case. So I think it's really curious that this position just happened to be made right before the pandemic hit. And that, like, this is the person we are getting our main health advice from. You know, he's televised frequently. And there's no, you can't vote somebody out of office because there was no vote into office. And so I don't know if this is the same or a similar situation that you have in Canada, but I just kind of wanted to know your thoughts on people who are, you know, have these titles of health officials. If you kind of do some digging to learn about how they get to where they are. Yeah. Just kind of wondering what your thoughts are on all of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot to unpack there. I think, you know, take a guy like Fauci, for example. Like, when last did Anthony Fauci see a patient? Yeah. Never. Like, 40 years ago, maybe never. I don't know. But I can tell you, certainly not in the last few decades, he has not seen a patient. So, you know, there's bureaucratic healthcare, which is the revolving door between organizations like the FDA, the pharmaceutical boards, et cetera. And there's major problems there as well. I mean, I'm not the first person to voice those concerns. Yeah. So the ties essentially between governing bodies, government itself, and then these, you know, pharmaceutical companies and whatnot. So that in and of itself creates massive conflicts of interest. And what you will find is people will just go back and forth, right? Yeah. So a couple of years later, they're on the board for Merck. And then next thing you know, they're on the FDA and so on and so forth, right? The CDC and what have you. So there's problems there. But I think the other thing is, you know, I think one of the biggest blunders, if you will, across the world has been the, over the course of the last couple of years, has really been the disconnect between the data that we're seeing and the public messaging. And so what, you know, that brings me to another point, which I should have said earlier, is the politicization of science. And so once you start throwing in the politicization of science, because we experience that here, like, to the same degree, if not worse, than you do over there. So the politicization of science now and, you know, the messaging that follows from that, that there's a major disconnect between what the data and what the science is showing. And I'm talking about all of the science and data, like the objective scientific data, and what we're being messaged at from a public health perspective. And I think that one of the things you're going to find, and I'm sure many of your listeners will probably resonate with this, is that a lot of people, you know, we've lost faith in institutions over the last couple of years. And one of the reasons why we've lost faith is because of that disconnect between what we are observing in the real world with our own eyes, the conversation that's going on around science and information, and then what we're hearing from, you know, mainstream media, from public health officials and whatnot. And, you know, and it's unfortunate because I think, you know, no one wants to think that there's any, I don't even want to use the word agenda, but I think everyone would love to, I mean, certainly I would love to believe that we are being presented the truth in an objective fashion and that there's no hidden motives behind what we're seeing. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people are starting to realize, well, hang on a second, why am I seeing this over here? And there's this bit of information over there that makes perfectly good sense related to what I'm seeing with my own eyes. But when I turn on the television and look at public health officials, they're telling me something completely different. And the policies that they're putting in place are completely counter to what I'm seeing play out in the real world. And that has really eroded a lot of trust in public health, for sure.
Yeah, goodness, you brought up so many great points there. I think that kind of brings me into the next section of this conversation that I want to have with you on ethical and logistical concerns regarding our current model of health. So one problem that I see is like there's no competition. I think one of the physicians that I listened to commented that the pharmaceutical companies are basically an oligopoly, if I can say that word right.
Yeah.
That they're all kind of owned by the same small group of people, and that there's a big conflict of interest there because it doesn't matter who you necessarily get your drugs from, because they all answer to the same people anyways. And I think that for me, that raises a lot of concerns, ethical concerns. There's no risk. I think both during the pandemic, both the US and Canada bought the drugs that are being administered from Big Pharma for distribution. So there's an issue with that. There's an ethical issue with that. And I don't know how it works in Canada, but in the United States, there was the HR 5546 bill passed in 1986. If you were to be injured by these drugs that are being passed, you cannot, they are not financially liable. It's you're taking this at your own risk anyways, but we're going to force you to take it.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually the 1986 law that you cite has somewhat been mapped out universally across the globe.
Okay.
So at the start of the pandemic, that was actually one thing that the drug companies did, was they petitioned every single member of the World Health Organization, and they basically lobbied them and said, you know, we're rushing this to market because we are in an emergency situation. And because we're rushing it to market, we're not going to be liable for any injuries or what have you, right? Mm-hmm. And that went around the world. So I don't actually know, at time of recording, I don't know if they are liable for any damages in any country around the world right now.
I didn't know that.
Which is astounding. I mean, look, you know, if you want to just like boil it down into something, a simple analogy here, you know, it's the only product that only works if everyone takes it. Okay. But you're also completely exempt and shielded from any liability. Like, Just, you know, just someone might have to just hit the back button on that and just listen to it again, because that really encapsulates everything here, right? And can you imagine if I was a car manufacturer, right? And all of a sudden I made these cars, I took them for test runs, and well, in the test runs, you know, half the cars, the steering wheel fell off, but whatever, that's okay. We just didn't tell anyone that the steering wheels fell off. And then what started to happen in the real world was, oh my gosh, all these people, steering wheels started falling off and people were crashing into trees and getting injured. And we basically just said, well, that's, you know, the steering wheels are fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And we're not going to be responsible for any of your injuries either. But what we're also going to do is we're going to make sure that our car is the only car that is going to be on the road. And you're all going to have to drive those cars if you want to drive the car. You know, in any company in the world, it doesn't matter what you are making. I mean, the chair that I'm sitting on right now, if this chair broke and other people started saying that their chair was breaking, there would be a full inquiry into the person who made the chair, and they would have to adhere to safety standards and whatnot before the chair got back on the market. You know, it's that simple. Yet we're in the situation now where the onus is being put on the public. You know, it's sort of like saying, hey, we rushed this thing to market, everything is fine, we're not going to show you all the data, now we're having to like really work hard to look at clinical trial data and raw data, and you know, if you have a problem with that, then you're just going to have to prove it, yeah. You know, and that's the end of the conversation, which is kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to, I approach things as like, it's not good or bad. It just is. And I try to, as best as I can, have just complete openness. And like, these are the issues that I'm finding when I'm looking at, you know, because of the pandemic, I think a lot of us have reevaluated our own health. Mm-hmm. We kind of reevaluated our own healthcare systems. I mean, I was working in the hospital in acute care until December of 2020. So I was working during the
pandemic. Oh, wow. Okay.
In the hospital setting. You know, I got to experience firsthand, you know, what worked and what didn't work and why things were not working. And so you start asking questions and, you know, and please stop me if I'm ever asking, because I know I'm talking about sensitive topics. Please stop me if I'm ever asking you a question that's uncomfortable.
I'm all good.
Okay. I have never talked about this issue on my podcast, and I, you know, I really don't want to upset anybody. I'm really seeing some opportunities for growth with our healthcare system, some opportunities for improvement. I'll try to spin that positive way instead of saying they're not doing a good job. And another, so we talked about no competition. I have some real issues with that.
If I can come back to that, can I come back to that? Yeah. Please. You know, the whole idea of no competition, the whole idea of a monopoly or what have you, I think even just, you know, you can park that and not even talk about it again. The thing that people need to realize is that when you look at the pharmaceutical industry, right, the pharmaceutical industry, along with things like automobile industry, right? These are cornerstones or pillars of the economy, of the global economy. And when you think about it like that machine has to run. It has to go in order to support the economy, right? From a foundational level. Like imagine tomorrow if we all just said, oh, we're just going to stop manufacturing cars. Right. So if you stop manufacturing cars, well, there's a whole portion of the economy that's going to tank, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing. If we don't have I'm not saying that pharmaceutical companies are these big evil, you know, conglomerates. Absolutely not. You know, if you get hit by a bus or you need emergency care, or like, you know, modern medicine has really transformed our lives in a very positive way in many instances. But the other side of that coin is that we've created a system that requires you to stay in that system. Mm. Okay. The way I practice, I want to get you well and then move along, you know, next, you know, let's help someone else. So that the goal for me is always to work myself out of a job. And I think a lot of people in the health and wellness industry, especially practitioners, that's what we do, right? You know, I don't want to work with you for 5 years and keep stringing you along and siphon you for money. Like, I wouldn't feel good, right? My goal is to get you well, move along. And if you have friends, sure, refer them or what have you, right? But the medical system is a very different system entirely. The system is designed to keep you in the system.
Yeah.
Right. And it comes back to that suppressive medication. So if I've got a hole in the wall and water is coming out and I go there and I put my finger in the hole or I put a plug in the hole, great. I didn't stop the water. I didn't fix the wall. And as soon as I pull that plug out, the water is going to come flooding back. So I have basically become fully dependent on that plug.
Yeah.
And the more holes I have, the more plugs I'm going to need. And that is really what medicine does. And forget about acute care or ER care or something like that. I'm talking about, you know, the management of health, not the management of disease, the management of health, the management and the treatment of chronic degenerative disease, which is what most people are suffering from, mm-hmm. is certainly in North America. We are, you know, the pharmaceutical drug model, surgery model is not equipped. It's not designed on a fundamental level to get you well. It's designed to manage your symptoms, to create the illusion that you're healthy, and to keep you dependent on that system. And that is how we have created this robust pillar of the global economy. And then, of course, because we also live in a world where we can't just have stagnation, we can't have atrophy, we must have continued growth. We need to continue growth and we need to continue to make more money. The economy needs to grow. And I've always said this for years. It's crazy to me that the economy needs to grow because there's nothing in nature, short of maybe crocodiles and sharks, there's nothing that grows infinitely. You know, everything gets to a finite point, like, and then you stop growing. And you mature, you get old or what have you, right? And yet we find the economy, which is an extraction-based economy, it rips natural resources out of the earth. You know, that's the fundamental basis of our whole economy. This economy now must just like somehow infinitely grow. You know, which is such a crazy concept. And again, coming back to the pharmaceutical industry, it's one of the cornerstones of that growth. So you need more people. You need more people on medications and drugs. You need to make them dependent on that. And again, I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. You know, of course, if someone has type 2 diabetes and they need insulin, sure, like go for it. You know, if you have lifelong hypothyroidism and you're dependent on thyroid medication, then that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But unfortunately, what we're finding out there is that, and you know, and I think anyone listening to this will see this just go and look around, ask your friends and your family. People are not necessarily experiencing optimal health and vibrancy and, you know, peak performance and all that, yet they're on these medications, you know, forever, which is a crazy situation, you know, to be in. And that brings up some major ethical concerns, as you were talking about before.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. And I say too, like there's a time and a place for everything. And having worked in acute care for quite some time, I think the hospital is really great at managing, you know, the person in the ski accident or the person that was hit by a bus or,
you know,
XYZ. But it was our, and I'll use air quotes, our frequent flyers, our people that were constantly coming back because they had chronic health conditions. And it was kind of disheartening. You know, I'd see my colleagues kind of roll their eyes and be like, oh, Mr. Jones is back. He must have not been following his directions. And it's like, well, no, we didn't help Mr. Jones. We didn't do our job for Mr. Jones because Mr. Jones is back. It was just that we're so quick to kind of blame the patient when
yeah.
It was the internal mistake. We didn't set Mr. Jones up for success. We did a lap Coley on Mr. Jones and expected him to go home and digest fats. And that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, again, it comes back to that fundamental understanding of health and disease, right? So, you know, a lot of people will sort of think that natural medicine or alternative medicine is trying to be like allopathic medicine, you know, like somehow we're this bastard stepchild of Western medicine. And it's like, no, we're not at all. In fact, like the whole view is very different. And so coming back to your analogy, you know, if you have, you know, patient X, whatever comes into the hospital and you do a procedure and you send them home and then they're back in, you know, what does that tell you? It tells you that A, you're not fixing the problem, right? Because again, you're not, the system's not designed to fix problems. The system is designed to manage problems. All right. But the other big thing here, and I think that the pandemic has really brought this into sharp focus over the last couple of years, is that we need to tack onto the front of our healthcare system a preventative model and a lifestyle. We need to start helping people with lifestyle medicine because we are suffering mostly from lifestyle diseases. And no matter what you want to say and how you want to cut the data, the overwhelming majority of people that have had the most severe fallouts from COVID-19 have had one or more comorbidities. Everyone knows that. There's nothing controversial about that whatsoever. And those comorbidities all happen to be lifestyle diseases.
Yeah.
Diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and what have you. So why are we not educating people on the front of the healthcare system? And I say healthcare system universally, globally. Why are we not educating people on food? Why are we not talking about diets? Why are we not talking about, you know, healthier lifestyle choices? You know, and I look at someone like the Cleveland Clinic, right? So, you know, functional medicine, I practiced functional medicine a little differently from others, I would think. And that's because of the sort of holistic streak that I have running through me. You know, when you look at, I'll just say functional medicine right now, okay? People often ask, what is functional medicine? What does it mean, right? And functional medicine, you know, when I run lab tests on people, I'm not running lab tests to diagnose disease. I'm running lab tests to evaluate metabolic function. Huge difference there, right? Huge difference. I don't care, like, whether you have diabetes or not. I want to see why you have diabetes. And then the second part to functional medicine is restore function. Okay, so I want to evaluate function, and then I want to restore function. Now, when you just keep that in focus and then map that onto things like the Cleveland Clinic, for example. You know, Cleveland Clinic, top-notch organization. They have a huge functional medicine kind of pillar that underpins them. And we've got data coming out of the Cleveland Clinic whereby they have shown that people going into group programs for lifestyle diseases, such as diabetes and heart disease and what have you. So they put them in a group and they do group coaching once a week for 10 or 12 weeks. 50% of the people in those groups never have to see their primary care physician. That's half of people. You know, think about that, especially for you sitting in the US where you're paying a lot for healthcare. How empowering is that from so many different levels? You know, you've now taken someone, you've put them in a community of people that are all experiencing the same thing. You've created camaraderie. You've shown them how to improve their lifestyle habits, their diet, everything else. And because of that, they start feeling better to the point where they don't have to go on medication and they don't have to see the doctor. You know, I don't know about you, but here in Canada particularly, they're crying all the time because the healthcare system is broke. You know, they say, oh, we don't have enough hospital beds and we don't have enough money for healthcare. And I'm like, well, hang on a second. You know, is it an infrastructure problem or do we have too many sick people? Because I think that it's not that we don't have big enough hospitals. I think we have too many sick people. And if we help those people to not be sick and prevent them from having to come into the medical system in the first place, you would have far less people in the system. But that doesn't work for the pharmaceutical companies. It doesn't work for the people making money off sick people. You know, and again, as I say this, I'm not trying to be inflammatory at all. I mean, it's just, it's plain logic when you look at this problem like this. And I think that one thing that I'm predicting in the future, it's already happening, but I think that we're going to see, and I really hope that we see this, that we really reverse our whole medical model entirely. Because the way that it works now is you tack on, you know, acute type of care, you tack on drug therapy and surgery and whatever, that's on the front of the system. And then what we do on the back of the system is once someone's gone through that entire system of specialists, of what have you, then they come and see people like me. So every single patient that I work with has gone through the medical system and they're frustrated, they're tired, they're like, oh my gosh, I've been on all these drugs, I've done the surgery, I've done, and I'm not getting better. So why don't we flip that around and put prevention, lifestyle medicine on the front? And then for the people that don't get benefited from that, maybe the 50% of the people that have to see their primary care physician, maybe those are the people that need to be put on drugs or have to have surgery or what have you. And that to me seems like a far more sustainable and logical, you know, view of healthcare in my mind.
Yeah, I don't know anybody that's gone into functional medicine because traditional medicine worked. Don't know.
Not one.
So I think, yeah, I most of the people I interact with also have, you know, been to, I think the average number is like 7 doctors.
Yeah.
And it's really unfortunate. Yeah. And that's a whole other issue. So back to this idea of, you know, logistical and ethical issues with our current model of health. We have no competition, no risk. Something you had mentioned, flip-flopping. So people in charge of the CDC or FDA are going back and forth between pharmaceutical companies. And that's a big conflict of interest. I think the real popular one is the CEO of Monsanto, Michael Taylor, went back and forth between Monsanto and the FDA. I don't know how many times.
Yeah.
I think he actually got in trouble. But yeah, I think that's really... And this is, I mean, anybody can look this up. This is easy information for you to find if you're questioning this. Look and see who's in charge of the CDC, and then look at what they used to be in charge of. I think that is. I wish there was something in place to prevent that from happening.
Well, it's challenging because, you know, we do have to rely on industry insiders for information. Like, they are the experts. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I wanted to know about a chemical, whatever that chemical is, and let's say I'm trying to regulate that chemical, I'm going to have to speak to the people that made the chemical. I'm going to have to speak to the chemist. So that in and of itself is not a problem. The problem is that when that chemist comes over and is now also the regulator, the question then is, what are your ties with the chemical company still? And that's where we run into these ethical sort of conflicts of interest, right? Because obviously we need a chemist to be able to help us to regulate the chemical, right? I mean, it's obvious. But and that's where the waters get muddy. But I think if you look especially at a place like the U.S., go and look back over the decades. And unfortunately, there's a lot of backdoor deals and glad-handing and lobbying and stuff like that goes on. I mean, certainly in the pharmaceutical industry, I think pharmaceutical lobbyists on Capitol Hill outnumber all other lobbyists by 3-1.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think on the low end, it might be 2-1. But my point stands. Yeah. You know, so there's a lot of them that are lobbying all the time for different rules and regulations and whatnot. And of course, it creates conflict of interest. You know?
Yeah. And then my final point that I wanted to bring up with ethical and logistical issues with our current model of health is hypocrisy in treatment. Are you seeing that or experiencing that?
In what context, if you can maybe just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I hear. So going back to my personal experience working in the hospital setting, different levels of care, I think people, and I want to say this in a way that's not triggering, you know, based on personal health decisions that people have made, people are being treated differently. Mm. And I actually had to like turn off my Facebook notifications because I was seeing too many statuses of disgruntled, you know, employees that were like, oh, I'm tired of working with people like this.
Yeah.
And I think that's problematic. We didn't used to ask somebody, you know, what's your status when you enter, you know, whatever. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think that, you know, if we just zoom right out, it comes back to what I was talking about before, right? And I want to make my position very clear, and I've had to do this on my own podcast from time to time, is I'm a huge fan and I'm a believer in freedom of choice. Okay, so that's one. And I think even more correctly, I will say I am firmly against mandated medicine. I think that anytime you mandate medicine, you know, and it comes back to what I was saying in the beginning of the show, where, you know, informed consent basically means that I have all of the available information, okay, available information, and I have looked at all of that information, and I am basing my decision based on that information. Okay, so that's one. So right now, we do not have informed consent, plain and simple. We are not exercising our right to informed consent because we don't have all of the information. And if anyone wants to, you know, challenge me on that, it's quite simple. Go and see if you can find all of the Pfizer raw clinical trial data. You can't, because they tried to get that buried for 50 years. They actually petitioned a federal judge in the U.S. and they said, we will not make this data available for 50 years. Which I think 55 years, I think it was, so 2076 or something crazy. So, you know, and that, of course, right there doesn't exactly instill a lot of trust or confidence when someone's trying to bury data for that long, right? So first and foremost. But the point is that we do not have all of the available data to make an informed decision. We do find that with these, with all of the vaccines, they are still in the clinical trial stage at time of recording. Again, that's not conspiratorial. That is, you know, we're in phase 3 trials. These are the fastest vaccinations ever to come to market, ever. So I think the previous record was, I think it was 6 years, 5.5, 6 years for the MMR vaccinations. And here we see that in a year, these came to market. Okay, so the point here is that we've accelerated this whole process. And some people might want to say, oh, but we've been looking at mRNA technology for 30 years. It's like, true, we have. But we've never actually been able to get anything approved in that because the trials never, ever worked out. So we've had a very, very difficult time moving even beyond animal trials for mRNA technology. And again, my point is in the context of all of this, right? If we had been developing these specific COVID-19 vaccines and mRNA technology for years, I would probably have less of a problem with it. You know, great. But it's been rushed to market, right? We're still in the clinical trial, phase 3 trials. We're still there. You know, there is lots of data to show that there's at least problems. I won't even get into what those problems might be, but that there are some problems, you know. And if you look at something like the VAERS system, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, if you look at the yellow card system in the EU, regardless of whether you want to say these are accurate or capturing all the data or not, I can tell you that they are heavily underreported, plain and simple. But the point is that there is a massive signal that we're seeing there. So if you look back at 15, 20 years, the history of VAERS, for example, what you're going to see is you're going to see a line that that sort of goes along the bottom, right, for adverse events and deaths and what have you. And then what you're going to see is in 2021, there is a hockey stick spike that just goes through the roof. And the point is that we are only 1 year into this. So coming back to your question here or your comment on, you know, should people be punished? Well, the question should really be, can we mandate this knowing what we know, right? Because I'm all about freedom of choice. Like if you do you, no problem. You do you, let me do me. And that's fine. Like, and if you want to get 10 boosters or 15 boosters or whatever, you should do that. And if you want to stay at home, I'm not the whole mask thing, I'm so ambivalent about it. I'm like, whatever, you know, that's not the cross I'm going to die on or what have you. Like, it's not my battle. I haven't got into any debates about it. I could care less. But this is something that is a lot more serious. And we have to now consider as well that even the data that we have in terms of adverse events, some of those adverse events have not manifested yet. You know, what is happening in long-term issues, for example, autoimmunity or cancer and stuff like that might take another 3 to 5 years. And so my point being here is that you cannot mandate something like this where we are not clear on what the outcomes are going to be. And then forget about, you know, the whole, I mean, straightforward, we know that it doesn't stop transmission. We know that it doesn't stop infectivity. We've kind of settled on this whole idea that it reduces severe symptoms and reduces deaths, right? And fair enough, I can get behind that. But the point is, what is the collateral damage here? And should we be mandating something that is overwhelmingly underpromised? Let's just put it that way. And if anyone wants to challenge me on that, take a look around. How many people have COVID right now? Take a look at Israel, Germany, the UK, like the world over. So, you know, if nothing else, we should have seen those numbers go down. And I don't even want to argue about why those numbers are going up. The point remains that this unfortunately has not been the ticket out. And so my question is, how can we mandate something that is actually proven to either do very little in terms of getting us out of this, or at least, or possibly even making things worse in the long run? And not from a COVID perspective, from an overall health. And that's something that we really need to start looking at. And I think we will start looking at that moving forward, is all cause mortality. And, you know, I mean, just think about, like, I don't know if you have children, but I got 3 kids. And, you know, my daughter is 14, going on 15. My son is 6. And then I've got a little girl. And, you know, I can see the impact that this has had on their mental health and their friends. You know, lockdowns and masks and, you know, school closures and all that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, we can't just look myopically and say, okay, you know, vaccine, COVID, end of conversation. We need to zoom right out and say, like, what are all of the public health measures that we've put in place? What are all of these things, and what has the collateral damage been in many other areas as well? And then let's look at that in totality and see, are we on the right track? You know, and then allow people to exercise their right to informed consent and make decisions for themselves and their family. I think any rational, sane person would be okay with that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I try to stay out of, I'm not pro or anti anything. I don't like being put in those, but I love the way you said it. Like, you do you. I think everybody should have the right to make their own decisions. But I'll take even what you said a step further. And regardless of the efficacy of this, let's pretend that it was super effective, and it is considered the kind thing to do. When you enforce people to do the kind thing, it's no longer kind.
Right. And what you're doing, you know, and I'll tell people exactly what's going on here in Canada right now, you know, at time of recording anyway. You know, we in Quebec particularly, I'm in Ontario, but in Quebec, they are now going to tax people that are not vaccinated. Okay, so actually a physical monetary tax on top of all the other taxes that people pay. You are not allowed to go into any big box stores, right? So the only stores you can actually go into are grocery stores, and you can go into drug stores, and that's it. So you can't go into a liquor store, you can't go into any other store at all.
Wow.
Right. And if you do go into those stores, this just got announced today, you have to have a health warden that chaperones you through the store. You know, so this is, I mean, this, it sounds like I'm making it up. That's how crazy it is, right? Yeah. And the point here is that what we're saying is, when you know, it's one thing to encourage vaccine uptake. And I think that everyone would agree that we've faced a relentless PR campaign to encourage vaccine uptake, right, the world over. But at some point, you know, I think we're finding a lot of people now that did their part. You know, so they said, hey, we got our two shots, we've worn our masks, we closed our businesses, we've done what we needed to do. It's going on 2 years now. And now, what are you saying? Now, to keep my passport green, I have to all of a sudden get boosters, and I have to, you know, and no one here as well, no one has been exempt from lockdowns. It's not like people that got vaccinated could suddenly move freely about. That hasn't happened either. They lock everyone down. You know, so a lot of people now are waking up to this idea that, okay, we complied, we did all the things that were asked of us, and nothing has changed at all. You know, we're still right back in the same boat that we were in March of 2020. You know, but now we've got this whole vaccine mandate that's orbiting around us the whole time. And, you know, the point here is that when you look at it through that lens, all of a sudden, I think a lot more people are starting to question where are we going here? And what is the outcome? Like, where does this end? You know, at what point do we say this is a good benchmark? Because we've also heard, when 75% of people get vaccinated, well, now it's 80. Okay, hang on, now it's 85 and then 90. And we've actually had our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, I don't know how you even calculate this, but over 100%. Okay, so we need over 100%. So, but even if that was the case, the point is that we now are looking at waning efficacy, we're looking at different variants, we're looking at all this stuff, and we're moving into a time now where I'll stop myself short of saying we're becoming dependent on boosters, because that will open up a whole different conversation. But certainly, in order to maintain your status, the U.S. is recently, they're toying with the idea of changing the definition of fully vaccinated to updated, you know, so you're up to date. You know, that tells me that there's no end to this. And so again, this has got nothing to do with whether you're pro or anti or whatever. This is, you know, we need to start looking at the long-term path here, and we need to really ask ourselves, is my right to access food, okay, because they've done this in other countries where you can't even get to the grocery store, right? So in Cyprus, in Austria, they said you can't get food. You know, so this should be ringing some bells for people. Like, at what point where does that stop, first of all? But are we okay with that as a society? You know, are we okay with, you know, what's going to happen when you're on your eighth booster and your passport's green, and then all of a sudden they turn it off and they say, sorry, you didn't get your ninth? Like, at what point is it going to be the 15th shot? Is it going to be the 50th shot? When are we going to say, like, hang on, something's not adding up here? Because as I said, between March 2020 and now, nothing has changed. Certainly here anyway. And I know different parts of the US, particularly the Northeast, and those areas, nothing has changed at all. Again, we need to really start asking these questions, and that's why there has been such an uprising around the world, because more and more people are asking these questions. And I think that from a scientific perspective, I think it's perfectly acceptable. In fact, we should be encouraging questioning. How crazy is it that we just you're not allowed to question anything all of a sudden?
Being
Like
discouraged. Yeah, it's crazy how people are being punished for asking questions and censored and taken off of different platforms. And I think that's why I've been afraid. I hate to use that word, but afraid to talk about this topic because of just being my message just disappearing. But
yeah.
this is bigger than do you agree with this drug or not? Like, that's not the issue. The
No,
issue is
no.
what's happening to our freedom right now? Because, and I'm no history buff, but I can't find an instance in history where a freedom was taken and then it was just given back. Like, you have to fight to get it back if you want to get it back once it's gone. And that concerns me for future generations, for like our kids and grandkids. Like, what is the world going to look like if we don't start talking about this and doing something about it?
Right. And, again, like questioning things, I mean, that's really the core tenet of science. Like, that's what science is questioning, right? And then testing, questioning, testing. But, I think that to zoom out and just to look at us from a societal or global problem, people like to sort of say, oh, freedom, freedom, or, and they kind of poo-poo on that whole idea when you say, oh, you're fighting for freedom. And they say, well, what's the problem? Are you in jail right now? Are your rights and freedoms really being eroded? And I think that because people have very short memories, I don't think a lot of people really know what it took to actually get things like the Constitution, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the Bill of Rights, and some of these documents. What did it take our founding forefathers to be able to even create those documents? What were peoples around the world? What kind of trials and tribulations were they escaping from, so that we can actually have the life that we have right now? So it's not a question of, oh, I feel like I'm in a prison right now. It's a question of, once these fundamental inalienable human rights, these are God-given rights. Forget about the Constitution for a minute, but your right to access food, clean water, to protect your family, to have shelter, these are God-given inalienable human rights. And that is what we are faced with here, is when you talk about restrictions like I've just laid out, you are infringing on those basic human rights. And that, for me, is a big problem. Especially, again, coming back to what I was saying earlier, who stands to profit? Who stands to profit? Like, if there was no profits involved and we were just saying, oh, this is just one big philanthropic movement and we're just going to hand out drugs and vaccines like candy and who cares, we're all in this together, then I might be fine with that. But unfortunately, we have seen over the last 2 years the biggest transfer of wealth up. The concentration and transferring of wealth up the ladder to the point where the 10 richest people in the world doubled their wealth, if not more, over the last 2 years. And who suffered? People like you and me, the middle class. So again, not to get political, but when you look at school closures, business closures, supply chain disruptions, and stuff like that, that affects your average working person. And these are the same people now that are, in many instances anyway, are being subjected to these restrictions, are feeling the pressure of these restrictions, and that is affecting their livelihood on a very fundamental level. And I think that, again, no matter what side of the aisle anyone sits on here listening to this, I think we all need to give our heads a bit of a shake and just sort of take a step back and say, hang on, am I okay with that? Like, am I okay if that, even if it's not happening to me, am I okay with that happening to someone else? And I think if you sit and think for any length of time, you're probably going to arrive at the same conclusion that most of us are at, and that is that it's not okay. And again, it comes back to the freedom to choose, right?
Well said. Do you have a moment for one more question?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no problem.
So I love how on your show, you talk about solutions. Like I hate to end on like a doom and gloom sort of, I'm not totally a doom and gloom person. So I would love to end with like, what do you feel like are some solutions to this problem? Like what can we be doing to protect ourselves and our freedom of choice?
Yeah, I think, you know, at some point we're all going to have to collectively step up to the plate together. And we need to realize that this is not a political, you know, left versus right or Democrats versus Republicans or whatever. It's not about that at all. What this is, and I don't like to use the word war, but this is a class war. This is really the people that sit way on the top making all the decisions and have all the money and what have you, and the rest of us at the bottom. That's what that is. So we all need to start realizing that, and I think that some of your listeners, and certainly I've experienced it, is you start connecting with people that normally you would not have connected with, right, over the last couple of years. So, you know, when you think about how you connect with people, it might be over a sports game or something like that. And now all of a sudden you're connecting with people on completely different issues. And when you start speaking with them, you're like, oh, wow, like your values and the things that you're into are completely different to mine. And so I love that, right, in a very positive way. But the point that I'm getting at here is that, you know, we need to start stepping up and uniting as a human family, first of all. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to do that is start connecting with your local community, right? Because as you know, what we've done here, and especially with the digitization of everything, is we have, it's very easy. Like, I don't have to go anywhere in order to survive, right? I can just sit right here. I can order food. I can order all my goods. I can order whatever I want, right? I don't have to go anywhere. And what that's done is it's put screens between human beings. And we've forgotten what it's like to actually interact with human beings. And so one of the things that I've done, I live in a small town outside of a big city. And one of the things that I've done is I've really made an effort to connect with people in the community. I've made an effort to connect with local farmers, with local businesses. And what that really gets to is the decentralization of things. So instead of relying on Amazon or Apple or whatever, start relying on the people next door to you, right? Because that community, you know, I think over the last decade at least, possibly even more, the erosion of community has really happened on an unprecedented level. You know, historically, your farmer's market would be like the town square, and that's where people would meet. You know, that doesn't really happen anymore at all. So I think we need to start getting back to that. Like, that's first and foremost, is start relying on your own community, start knitting that fabric back together again, and not be so focused on what's happening on the other side of the world, right? So there's that. And the other thing that's really helped me personally is I try and be very selective of the information that I'm taking in, because we are living in the misinformation age, I would say. And we're bombarded with so much data and so much information that it's very difficult for your brain to try and actually take in all of that information. We all suffer from it. And so being selective about what you bring in, also very important, is people that I follow and subscribe to, I subscribe to things that I don't agree with. Okay, so I follow people that I don't agree with, because I want to understand, why does someone else think differently from me? How did they arrive at their conclusions, and so on? And that helps. It helps, at least in part anyway, to try and check my biases a little bit, even though we all have our own biases, we're human beings. But that's something that helps as well. I think on a more of a macro level, something that I said earlier is we need to really start thinking about how we, and you said it as well, we need to start thinking about how we approach healthcare on a personal level even, right? And so I think for people who are listening to this, who are maybe saying, well, you know, I need medication, or I'm not holistically inclined or not naturally inclined, I think that we need to start revisiting that, and people need to start rethinking that, because you are nature. You know, nature's not out there or something to interact with. You are nature. And so if you are looking at this from the lens of a pandemic, and you are worried about getting sick in a future pandemic or even in the current one, the best way and your best defense is to build yourself up from the ground up. And you're not going to be able to do that with drugs and surgery and pharmaceuticals. It's not going to happen. So taking better care of yourself, you know, this is something I've had to really, and it might sound quite contradictory coming from me, but over the last couple of years, I kind of like, you know, I wasn't paying as much attention to my health. I was spending way too much time, like especially in the early days, like people can go and listen to the podcast. I've done an exhaustive amount of research and interviews on all these topics, and that eats up a lot of your time and a lot of your bandwidth. And so, you know, you only have 24 hours in a day. Well, guess what? The self-care aspect started sliding. I was like, I got to save the world here, you know, and I'm not taking care of myself. And so I took a little break from the podcast. I've taken a step back from some of my roles on science advisory boards and supplement companies. I basically resigned a lot of positions and freed up some of my time so that I can spend more time with my family, with myself, you know, and take care of myself. And so I think that self-care, you know, I know it's very cliched these days, but I think that with everything going on these days, people are, I think self-care is kind of slipping by the wayside. And that, you know, eating right, taking care of yourself, paying attention to the information and the content that you're consuming, you know, so that it builds you up rather than tears you down. Because you're no good to anyone, you're no good to your family or your children or anything like that, if you're just like riddled with anxiety and fear about what's going on in the world. And I speak to myself about that because I have to remind myself about these things from time to time as well. I think those are good things, you know, I won't get into specific supplements or anything like that because, you know, I don't want to pigeonhole ourselves here, but just remember that your body is made of vitamins, minerals, herbs are part of nature. That's what, since the dawn of time, that's what human beings relied on to not just treat disease, but to keep themselves healthy. And you know, your body's not deficient in Tylenol or Prozac, it's deficient in vitamins or minerals. So once you start replenishing your body, build yourself up, strengthen yourself, make yourself more resilient, you're going to be in a much better position for you and your family to take on the challenges of the world.
Well said. That was beautiful. Well, Brett, I'm so thankful for the opportunity to speak with you. Is there anything that you wanted to mention that I haven't asked you about?
No, I think that's good. I mean, I think it's such a, you know, some of the issues we've spoken about today are just so huge and there's so much to unpack there that I don't want to overwhelm anyone with any of that at all. I think it's a good, I enjoyed our discussion today. I think it's great for, you know, people that are maybe starting to question these things and looking into them, and without going down rabbit holes and getting super crazy, we can still keep a level head and actually have level-headed discussions about these types of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll put links to where people can find you and your podcast in the show notes. If there's anything else that you would like me to share, I'm happy to put that in the show notes.
Great.
Yours is, I mean this, like one of my top like three podcasts. I think I've listened to every episode that you have released. I really love the information you put out there and the way you approach sharing information. I am not 18 years into practice, so I try to learn from people like you. So again, so thankful for you and your willingness to share your time and wisdom. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for tuning in. In this episode, we covered who sets the standards of health, who defines what wellness is and how to achieve it, how are healthcare officials appointed, ethical and logistical issues with the current model of health, and the information war. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share with a friend, and leave a rating and review. I have links where you can connect with Brett in the show notes, and you can also learn more about my company, The Holistic House, LLC, by visiting www.theholistichouse.org. Okay, everyone, time to go back out in the real world now. Be well and be kind.